This is the Criminal Law Revision Commission meeting, 1 p.m., March 20th, 1969, room 421, State Capitol Building. Today's subject, kidnapping and related offenses, preliminary draft number 3. Assault and related offenses, preliminary draft number 2.
We have a bare quorum, and it may be necessary to bring this matter up again. I certainly hope that it will not be. But since Tom Mahoney was defeated and is no longer a legislator, of course, he is not eligible to serve on the commission or to hold an office, and it is necessary that we elect a vice chairman. And I would like to declare nominations in order for that position.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to nominate Senator Burns, if I may, please.
Are there any further nominations?
Nominations closed.
Motion has been made and seconded that nominations be closed and the secretary be instructed to cast a unanimous ballot for John Burns as the vice chairman of the commission. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Congratulations.
That's what you get for opposing my city attorney.
I was just checking it out with Frank Knight, and he said, I'll wait to see if Representative Carson is here and how he's going to vote on my motion today.
We may not get through with both kidnapping and assault and related offenses today, but in any event, Wally Carson is the chairman of Subcommittee 2 that considered these matters. So now, Wally, I'm going to turn the meeting over to you to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and
The
discussion of kidnapping and related offenses is in subcommittee, I guess, of which I am the nominal head. However, I am quick to say that these were discussed before my appearance on the committee by some several months, and I'm not fully advised on all the intricacies of the program, but I'd be glad to struggle through, and perhaps Senator Lent or Mr. Thornton, who were you came on the same time I did?
Don's in
okay, maybe I'll just cut out to Don, Mr. Chairman, and kind of let him guide it through. I can read as well, but I don't see any point.
Fine, if you want to. Don, would you take over?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Incidentally, the minutes of the last committee meeting on assault were not distributed earlier because they've just been completed, but they are in your books.
Yes, we have. The commission minutes from the last commission meeting are in your black books, and then also you should have in front of you, and not in the book, but at your place at the table, a copy of the last meeting of subcommittee number 2, and we brought those along because that was the meeting in which the assault article was discussed. Now, as Representative Carson indicated, kidnapping-related offenses was considered by subcommittee number 2, by the old subcommittee, and this represents preliminary draft number 3, which is the approved version that came out of that subcommittee. Now, I hope that you had an opportunity to examine the provisions of this draft. As in other drafts of substantive offenses, we've proceeded along the same format. That is, we begin this article with a section on definitions. Now, these definitions apply throughout the article. The article is composed of 6 sections. A definitional section, kidnapping in the second degree, kidnapping in the third degree, unlawful imprisonment, and custodial interference in the second degree, and custodial interference in the first degree. Now, with respect to the definitions, as in previous drafts, the definitions in the abstract really aren't too meaningful until you get into the later sections in the draft and see how these definitions are employed within the definition of the crimes. Now, the key definitions, I would say, at this stage of the discussion in Section 1 are the definitions of restraint, which is defined as means to intentionally restrict a person's movements in such a manner as to interfere substantially with his liberty by moving him from one place to another, or by confining him either in the place where the restriction commences or in the place to which he has been moved without his consent and with knowledge that the restriction is unlawful. And then sub A and sub B under subsection 1 go on to define when a restraint is deemed to be without consent. The second key definition is the definition in subsection 2 of section 1, abduct, which means to restrain a person with intent to prevent his liberation by either A, secreting or holding him in a place where he is not likely to be found, or sub B, using or threatening to use deadly physical force. Now, if you'll turn over in your drafts to page 5, section 2 sets out the elements of kidnapping in the second degree. Now, the elements of kidnapping, as defined in this section, and as employing the definition set out in section 1, encompass the following elements: an unlawful restraint, knowledge that the restraint is unlawful, substantial interference with another's liberty, and an unconsented to restraint, secreting or holding the victim in isolation, and using or threatening use of deadly physical force. This sets out the basic crime of kidnapping. Kidnapping then in the first degree, the aggravated offense would be in those instances where the abduction was for the purpose of compelling any person to pay or deliver money or property as ransom, or to hold the victim as a shield or hostage, or in the alternative to inflict serious physical injury or to terrorize the victim of another person. The next section appears on page 10 of your draft. Section 4, unlawful imprisonment. And within the within the framework of the kidnapping and related offenses article, this is a new crime, unlawful imprisonment. That is new in the sense that we do not have a comparable statute under our present penal law. In section 5, custodial interference, getting into situations which sound of kidnapping in a sense, but do not come up to the magnitude of the crime itself. That will give you a broad overview of what the article attempts to do. And then if we could start then on page 5 with section 2, and as we go along through the sections, I think that the definitions that appear in section 1 will become more meaningful. Kidnapping in the second degree. A person commits the crime of kidnapping in the second degree if he abducts another person, set out in sub 1. And then under 2, and under subsection 2, we set out a defense. Now, there was quite a bit of discussion at the subcommittee with respect to this, whether or not we wish this to appear in the kidnapping article at all, or whether it should appear elsewhere in the code. But the feeling of the subcommittee was that we're talking about a defense that would apply specifically to the crime of kidnapping that should be set out here. And now A, B, and C all are required to make out the defense to the crime of kidnapping. And in those cases where there's an abduction that's not accompanied by an intent to use or threaten the use of deadly physical force, and the actor is a relative of the person abducted and his sole purpose is to assume control of the person, this would be a defense. the language of burden of injecting the issue is tentative language insofar as, although the commission has approved similar language with respect to defenses in the comprehensive theft article, we recognize in subcommittee that this provision would be subject to modification, and whether or not we would ultimately utilize the language of injecting the issue, which is language borrowed from the Michigan proposal, or whether we would frame it in the form of a defense and set out that the burden is on the defendant by a preponderance of the evidence, or whether we would set it out as an affirmative defense, recognizing that there are some subtle differences in it. But I think the policy decision of the subcommittee was that whatever form it ultimately took, whatever form the commission finally decided they wanted to use, that there should be a defense available if all of these factors were present. Now,
is the word deadly defined anywhere?
Deadly physical force, yes, is defined in our definitions article. And although at the time this draft was put together on kidnapping, the definitions had not been formulated. This draft proceeded on the assumption that the definition would be as it ultimately was put together. So the concept of what we're talking about by deadly physical force, and that is the kind of force that's likely to cause serious physical injury or death, was what the reporter had in mind. And I might mention, and I should have done this earlier, that this draft, as well as the assault article, was drafted by Gene Lavorato, who is no longer with the commission, unfortunately. And but she was the one who presented this to the subcommittee, and the one who did the basic background research on this article. Now, pages 5 and 6, 7, 8, and 9 all set out in the commentary how this relates to our present law. Actually, there isn't, as far as the concept and what we're talking about when we talk of kidnapping is not a very great departure from our existing law in substance. The structure's changed quite a bit, but we proposed two separate sections, one each dealing with a separate degree of the crime. But actually, our existing statutes in effect provide for the aggravated type of kidnapping and ransom situations.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. I'm not sure whether I'm interrupting you or not, but I want to direct my attention to this term that the chairman mentioned. And if I'm getting ahead of myself, you tell me. Well, the thing that bothers me about the term deadly physical force is its use where it is, and also because, as I read it, page 2, and appreciating that actually we haven't approved the definitions, but this assumes that we will. Deadly physical force, as I read it, is virtually a circular definition with serious physical injury. Serious physical injury means physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death, and then it goes on to have some other language which I have some question about, but not on this point. And then deadly physical force means physical force that under the circumstances in which it is used is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury. And I have read and reread those over a half a dozen times, and I think they are absolutely circular. If not absolutely circular, they are so close to being the same that I see no basic difference in it. In other words, if it's serious physical injury, if it creates, if it's a physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death, and it is deadly physical force, if it is used under circumstances that it makes it readily capable of causing serious physical injury. Now, if that isn't a circle, I'll put in with you. And particularly because the use of deadly physical force as a defense in kidnapping second degree means, I take it, that if you find that deadly physical force was used or threatened to be used, then the defense would not be made out and you would have second degree kidnapping. And but it would be first degree kidnapping if he, one of his purposes was to inflict serious personal, serious physical injury upon the victim or another person. And I can't see any difference between the two. And I think you're going to have a terrible time in framing indictments and in your proof problems. And I suspect that you wanted to have the enhanced or the greater penalty only where the circumstances were more serious, and yet I don't think you've done that. So I object to the... I'm not sure whether you ought to get at it by changing your definitions or not. And then while I'm on this soapbox, I'd like to call your attention to Section 4, which uses the term serious bodily injury.
Well, that should be corrected on there, Judge. That's a typographical error. If that still shows bodily,
I took it that perhaps that ought to be serious physical injury. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
that is
where are you?
Is physical under Section 4. That should read physical.
Yeah. It takes care of that. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Jim, I do agree that these, that there is this circuity in these definitions. One's defining an injury, the other's defining a force which produces injury. And I don't see that they are circuitous.
Well,
one case where you use the term deadly physical force, you're going to be concerned with the force which is used.
Well, except
it's capable of producing an injury which might result in death or serious physical injury.
Except that your definition section, kidnapping second degree, isn't kidnapping second degree if the abduction isn't coupled with intent to use or with a threat to use deadly physical force. Now, this doesn't mean that this doesn't say the use of deadly physical force, but merely the intent or threat. Now, kidnapping second to first degree says it's first degree if he abducts with the purpose to inflict serious physical injury. Again, that doesn't mean that he actually inflicts serious personal injury. It means it's defined in terms of the purpose to inflict. In other words, the threat or the circumstances under which there is a danger of this use, as opposed to the actual infliction of personal injury. As I read it, perhaps I read it incorrectly.
What we were trying to do here was to provide a defense in a very limited type of situation, and that
on the family situation.
Yes, and that even though the actor was a relative and he had the sole purpose to assume control of the person, in so doing he either intended to, there was evidence that he intended to use or had threatened to use serious or deadly physical force in the process, this defense even in those situations would not become available to him. And deadly physical force, now that definition becomes important not only in this section, but also when we get to the article on justification as a defense. which there are limitations if deadly physical force is used by the actor. That's the only other.
Well, I thought it might
think
be.
Of offhand,
it,
but
it might be also used in some of your. Perhaps some of your other personal crime sections. I don't know whether it is or not. I recall in the. Didn't we have some of this sort of same sort of thing in the robbery article? Perhaps.
Well, we had serious physical injury becomes important in the robbery context, and also it's extremely important in the assault draft. Now, our definitions, Judge, our definitions of serious physical injury and physical injury. Become important under our assault concept because the kind of injury that's inflicted is going to determine the seriousness of the assault crime. And I don't agree with you, frankly, that those are circuitous, but because I think, as Senator Lentz pointed out, that one is directed at the force employed, and one is directed at trying to describe the nature of the injury that's inflicted.
But if it's kidnapping in the first degree to abduct a person with the purpose of inflicting serious physical injury on them, would you not be able to make first degree out of any case where the circumstances were such that a substantial risk of death or serious disfigurement and so on were actually created? Let's say driving 90 miles an hour on a curving road would certainly create a substantial risk of death or serious injury. It might well be that would be the purpose, to scare the heck out of it, and the purpose to inflict severe injury on it.
Well, but Jim, under kidnapping in the first degree, do you think that it requires a purpose to use deadly physical force to inflict a serious physical injury?
Well,
you can inflict serious physical injury without use of a deadly physical force. But the thing that disturbs me is to use deadly physical force upon whom or upon what? What if you use a crowbar to open a door? Under second degree, upon the victim or another, or
causing death or serious physical injury, it has to be directed towards a person.
Yeah, well, of the victim or someone else, or
well, under kidnapping in the first degree, clearly it could be either the victim or another person.
Under first degree, yeah. Yes. But how about 2A under second degree?
Aren't you really in 2A there in section 2 talking about the abduction not coupled with the intent to use or threaten to use deadly physical force? Don't usually talk about if you threaten deadly physical force, aren't you really threatening physical injury? I mean, that gets my part of the problem is
Jim?
Deadly physical force is what's gonna cause serious physical injury.
It looks to me that there's a void unless there's something added to physical force. It has to be upon the victim or another or something.
Well, the way it's written, I agree, Tony. I think what it comes down to, though, is that you have threatening some person, because coming back to deadly physical force is only pertinent,
yeah,
if you're going to readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury.
Well, that's true, but do you think, I think it's right. I don't find the same problem that Frank or Jim do, but...
Well, take an example of second degree. To say it's the family situation, and so therefore we're wondering whether or not the defense is applicable or not. And he says, let's say it's the estranged father saying to his 13-year-old son, by George, you better come with me or I'll shoot you. Is that enough to take him out of the defense or make the defense unavailable? Is threatened to use?
I would say so.
Yes.
Well, it would if he said that he threatened to shoot him, because you can imply that he's going to use deadly physical force. But if he said, I'm going to kill you, it wouldn't, because that'd be just threatening death or serious physical injury, you see.
Well, the ABC are conjunctive in the second degree.
Well, they all have to exist in order to make the defense out.
Well, isn't I think, yeah, you were getting at just a minute or two, and I opened my big mouth and shut off your thought. Wouldn't you be consistent and avoid this if you got to, say, the abduction in this 2A is not coupled with intent to cause or threaten to cause serious physical injury? The abduction is not coupled with intent to cause or to threaten to cause serious physical injury, which takes care of your...
Yeah, that's what I'm...
Come with me or I'll kill you.
How do you really threaten to use deadly physical force? It's
what
more threatening.
Use that, you mean in place of sub A?
Yeah, use. Yeah. Instead of A, make it the abduction is not coupled with intent to cause or to threaten to cause serious physical injury, and get rid of this deadly physical force altogether.
I think you're right. I don't think you need it.
The wording in that section is difficult, because you have coupled with intent or coupled with to threaten, and the grammar is something ought to be done about that, because the use of the word to threaten is not consistent with the previous grammatical term. But I agree with what Bud says. I think that would, because as long as deadly physical force means anything that under the circumstances is readily capable of causing serious physical injury, then you would solve it by speaking in terms of physical injury in 2A. I agree with that.
Mr. Chairman, I sat in on the subcommittee that went over preliminary draft 2 and put this out in the form that we have it. And that subcommittee made the policy decision that we insert the defense as a part of kidnapping. And none of us have addressed ourselves to that. And I think it's probably the most significant policy decision that we'll make.
Can you state that again, please?
Well, we're putting in this ineffective defense section, which we don't presently have in the law. And what about the... I think that the commission should address itself to whether or not it's a good idea to have it in like this. Maybe, Don, you could tell us why you decided to go this way, because it is a departure.
Yeah. Now, the commentary speaks to this on page 7, the second beginning paragraph, indicates that what we're really looking at specifically here is the parental kidnap situation, and that... Now, of course, Oregon, as you know now, has not only kidnapping provisions, we also have a separate statute on taking away a child with intent to detain a parent. Now, as the commentary says, that courts have generally held that a parent who abducts his child is guilty of kidnapping if a custody decree has been entered, but not guilty in the absence of such a decree, because the parents would have equal rights to them. Child. But a minority of the states have departed from this rule by exempting parents from kidnapping altogether, or they've mitigated the seriousness of the offense. Now, the federal statutes, parents are exempt from the Federal Kidnapping Act, and when we were putting this draft together, we felt that generally parents should be exempt from kidnapping, and we have other sections that are directed affords that kind of situation, which would be a relatively minor offense, custodial interference. We felt there might be some instances in which, particularly considering that custodial interference would probably be a misdemeanor as it's ultimately graded, there might be instances in which, because of the nature of the action of the parent, that it would warrant a felony prosecution, possibly. And that, and particularly in the situations where the child is stolen and removed from the state, would present a problem if you had merely a misdemeanor statute dealing with it. And of course, I think now in the state that most of the situations that come up with respect to child stealing by a parent are handled not as a kidnapping situation, but under the taking away statute.
You say so. You threaten the kidnapping,
yeah,
to get them to bring the child back.
Yeah.
Then let them handle it.
Dan?
Don, this is so obvious, I'm probably clear off base, but it would seem to me that you could be guilty of kidnapping in the first degree in a relative situation, the estranged husband picking up a child and taking it home with him, when you couldn't be in the second degree, looking at sub 3, to inflict serious physical injury or to terrorize the victim or another person. And most of these situations arise, it is something of a terrorization of the mother or father, whichever party is involved. Would it be possible to be guilty of kidnapping in the first degree on the husband, the father, picking up a child and running off with him, and you couldn't be in the second degree? I'm sure that's not our intent.
We don't have a definition of terrorize.
We have no definition of terrorize, right.
One of the difficulties with that particular subject.
That's probably the key to it right there.
Because anybody's going to be terrorized. You can allege terrorization, and you find an awful lot of juries that agree with you in any of these cases that, in fact, terrorization resulted.
I think what Dave says is true, because in the commentary it says if the relative abducts the child for any other purpose, for example, extortion, terrorization of the mother, perpetuation of any crime upon the child, then the exclusion does not apply, and the abductor may be found guilty of kidnapping.
Yes, if they're going to take the child for the child's own good,
but
supposedly, I mean, that's a theory that they use, then fine, they're not guilty. They might be guilty of taking away the custody,
but the wife is terrorized.
Right, but if that's their purpose in taking the child away, then they're guilty of kidnapping,
yeah,
if they're trying to terrorize those.
So the moment she says, I'm terrified, you got a jury question on first degree kidnapping.
Yes,
you think you'll find it's usually the mother that comes back and she steals the child, and the father has custody rather than the other way around.
I don't know, it's probably the
way up. My experience down
there. Depends on what county, apparently.
Yeah. But was your question not just that they'd be guilty of first degree kidnapping, but would not be guilty of second degree? Was that the question?
Yeah, that's the question. Mm-hmm. Basically, it boils down to the word terrorize, I believe, as a definition of that. It seems to be rather a loosely definable term. Well, how do you terrorize somebody? I terrorize my wife all the time.
don't you say a word. Senderland.
Mr. Chairman, before we get to all these refinements, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to go back to ones even more basic for me. Both kidnapping in the second degree and kidnapping in the first degree here depend upon abducting someone. So that abduction is very key. All right, and we find out that back on page, whatever it is here, unnumbered, page 1, abduct means to restrain a person. So we've got to go back and find out what restrain means. We find that up in sub 1. Which is very interesting, because it gets down to this business of restricting him or taking him someplace and so on, without his consent and with knowledge that the restriction is unlawful. Well, now, what makes the restriction unlawful? Where do we say what is an unlawful restriction?
That's a term I don't like to see.
Without a definition of that, this is one that really feeds on itself.
Yeah.
You make abducting somebody, kidnapping, and that's the only way it gets to be unlawful.
We need it with knowledge that the restriction is unlawful in the first place.
Well, but even thus far outward, what's an unlawful restriction?
Well, you take that out, though, if you remove that part of the sentence, don't you?
Pardon?
You take out the words, and with the knowledge that the restriction is unlawful.
This is New York all the way.
Pretty much.
Yeah. What about the moral appeal for a kind of
here. It's going to occur in confiding.
It's in there, but I can't really understand why you have to have that in there, except maybe to define the mens rea, but can't you just have a criminal mens rea without having that, like, so some store owner says, well, I didn't realize I could lock somebody up that I thought was shoplifting, that I could keep him locked back up in that room up there for a couple days until the sheriff got out. I didn't know if that was unlawful.
I see the model penal code uses terrorize, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, without defining it.
Now, another problem, too, really to get down to nitpicking is, without his consent. That imputes consent can be given, and you have situations of children, incompetents, who are incapable of their of giving consent.
Well, we go on to say what without consent is, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here's a problem. If you take out the words, Dave, and with knowledge that the restriction is unlawful, then what about a policeman making an arrest?
Well, yeah, this is one of the things we discussed in subcommittee. I'll see if I can locate the discussion in the minutes here. From there. Well, I might mention this before I even get to the minutes here, that now restraint, of course, is used not only in the kidnapping sections, but restraint will come into play later on in other sections also. So, in other words, unlawful imprisonment, we're talking about restraint. But it speaks in terms of restraining, but not in terms of abduction. That definition of restraint was intended to cover that kind of situation where you would have a detention, say, by an officer or in a store, say in a shoplifting situation or something such as that, where we felt that there should be some language in there which would not place those within the framework of the penal sections.
Isn't there some better way of defining a mens rea for something without saying with knowledge that it's unlawful? I mean, technically a guy could kidnap somebody for ransom and everything else and come in and say, I didn't realize that that was against the law. Technically, if the jury would believe him, he has a good defense when he was intending to do specifically what we want to get at.
Now, Michigan doesn't have that problem, Don.
With
I don't
knowledge, Michigan is a model penal law.
No.
What you're really getting at is you want him to do it without his consent and with knowledge that the restriction is not privileged or authorized by some other rule. That's what you're really trying to get at.
That's right. Is there any member here who was on the subcommittee and this was considered?
Well, I was there as chairman.
I had substitute.
Gene isn't available either, is he?
Of course, in Model Penal Code Section 212.4, interference with custody, they talk about the children situation. And when he takes or entices from the custody of the parent, guardian, and so on, when he has no privilege to do so. Seems to me that in that type of section you don't need, for example, a definition of privilege.
Well, Illinois defines unlawful restraint as a person commits the offense of unlawful restraint when he knowingly, without legal authority, detains another.
Now there's the idea of getting out of
that. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. This is better. Just what was the word that the other one has? Not privileged. I mean, that's a
without legal
a better word than this. With knowledge or restriction is unlawful, because there are many.
I think this Illinois thing is that we have to incorporate into this some way.
What's the matter now with saying that without his consent and without legal authority?
nothing.
Legal authority would comprehend these other things, some sort of a justification.
Lawful arrest.
If the person can show legal authority, then he isn't restraining the guy. If he's restraining under legal authority, like the sheriff.
Judge Francis?
I was just wondering how this fact situation would apply. 1 o'clock in the morning, a person goes berserk. An officer goes out there. You can't file a sanity petition or anything. Apply this kind of a definition to a fact situation where you're confronted with the necessity of placing a person in confinement without any... assuming that this is the only law we're looking to.
Wouldn't that officer have legal authority?
Well, would he have legal authority? If you spelled some privilege in the statute, you might find a way of doing it. But here you have, I don't know, I've always assumed a lot of times that the officers just went out and took the law in their hands sometimes.
I know that
take an emergency
in Portland.
Take them to Holiday Park.
In Portland, you will find that some 20 to maybe 40% of your mental hearings originate where the person is actually taken into custody by an officer who doesn't lodge any charge against them, but the person is obviously disturbed, and they take him into custody and then take him out. Used to be out to Morningside Hospital. I don't know where they take him now. And there aren't any proceedings filed. He isn't arrested. But the first thing in the morning, they bring him down and they get the petition filed and so on. And I know that's a very typical situation.
I think there is a statute which provides for some kind of a temporary emergency act, but again, we go to this playing with words again. That's why I was thinking that
Carl,
if you can get touchy.
419, Frank, I think, or 436.
Carl, can you imagine a case of the kind you're talking about in which probably the person isn't, the officer doesn't see a crime being attempted in his presence? In other words, you got disturbing the peace usually or something of this kind that he can arrest for without a warrant. If a person's going berserk or he's about to threaten, creating risk of harm to himself or others, you got crimes that are being committed in the presence of the officer, and then you can arrest without a warrant.
Well, yes, I suppose that route could be followed, but I know that the practice, at least what I've observed, has been, as the judge indicated, they pick them up and place them somewhere, and in the morning they get the two petitioners.
They don't ever take them to jail. I mean, that's the idea, because the guy's sick, he isn't committing a crime.
I didn't live in Washington County, it was worth $27,000 last time.
The
statute here is 426.215. Any peace officer may take into custody any person who he has reasonable cause to believe is dangerous to himself or to any other person, and who he has reasonable cause to believe is in need of immediate care or treatment for mental illness. If a peace officer takes a person into custody under this section, he shall remove him forthwith to a hospital, etc. This was enacted in 65. This amendment, but until then, I think the police had problems as far as actually taking a person into custody. They had to find some crime.
Well, is this a privilege or is it lawful authority?
Well, it's legal authority.
Yeah, it was
legal authority.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
What do you think of that, Tom? Saying without legal authority. Because otherwise you are really just beating back yourself.
What you were striving for, Don, was knowledge that it was unlawful.
Or would you answer?
Well, what we were trying to do was to write an exemption into this thing so that there wouldn't be instances of
and without legal
such
authority.
As our hypothetical.
Well, but the intent, though, or the mens rea is from the intention to restrict or to interfere with his liberty.
That's right.
The intention. Heck, that's all you need.
Yeah, I like this. In fact, I can say I can't read, and I don't know there's any such law.
Well, it doesn't make a difference under this. It's when he knowingly, without legal authority, detains another.
We say intentionally, not.
Yeah.
Well, I can go back up to saying it's means to intentionally restrict.
Sure, he's doing it intentionally. He's intentionally restricting it.
And if he does it without the other person's consent and without legal authority, then you have the restraint to go down to be used in abduct, which then is used in defining your crime.
Which fits right. in the
so
rest the of it.
Intentionally would modify the without legal authority. Well, in all move, Mr. Chairman, that on sub-1 of section 1, after the word and, we say and without legal authority and strike the rest of the sentence.
Strike the remainder of the sentence.
Let's see, where are you?
Which sentence are you on, Joe?
Which line?
Third line from the bottom of sub 1.
Without his consent.
Without his consent and without legal authority.
Well, now that makes sense.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I glossed over the whole basic policy decision, which is whether or not we want to include the parental kidnapping as an offense. It would be, is there a child stealing section, Don, or something of this nature that would be a misdemeanor?
It would be covered.
Yeah, there is a fix under custodial interference.
Which would be a misdemeanor.
Would be a misdemeanor.
Not the extraditable.
Well, unless they take him across the state line, it becomes in the first degree. If he does the person take and ties him between the confines of the state, see, then you get up into the felony class.
The felony class.
Where do you get that? Where do you get that?
Well, there's a custodial interference in the second degree and custodial interference in the first degree. The second degree would be if they just take them over to Ontario, but if they go on to Napa.
Well, that was the reason it was put in there.
Yeah.
Exactly, that reason.
If they take them to Ontario, it should be a felony, I
think. Yeah. Now you're kind of
But you might have that situation where they go out of the state, but there's nothing else accomplished that would put it back into kidnapping.
I really didn't
need that. It would be custodial interference, but you need a legal machinery to...
Yeah.
Right.
My point is...
Get a federal crime.
Not if it's a crime.
I was very...
My point is that there wouldn't be an extraditable offense for taking across the state line in parental custody.
It is.
Because sometimes...
You just got to remember...
Practically speaking, you'll never
yet have. The
unless the commission decides to grade that differently than, you know, what we had in mind.
You get deported abroad, who can barely find a way to a lawyer's office, and then has a kid, you know, three states away.
Why don't we move along then, Don? Do you want to take any action on this amendment? A motion has been made that sub 1 of section 1, third line from the bottom, Senator Burns' motion, after the word consent, insert and without legal authority, and then strike out the remainder of that sentence. Is there any discussion?
Question.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Carried.
And Mr. Chairman, just for purposes of moving along, I'd move that we adopt the definitions as amended.
Well, I want to be heard before we... I'll second the motion. I want to be heard on two or three of these definitions.
Fine. Motion's been made and seconded. Discussion.
In 1 sub B, which speaks of the... defines when restraint is without consent, it says... if he is a person who's not reached his 16th birthday or is an incompetent, I would prefer to have the word is in there because I think it reads better, but, or is an incompetent person and the parent, guardian, or other person having lawful control and so on. Now, does this mean legally declared incompetent? I think we ought to be specific one way or the other on that because a person could very well have lawful control of someone who was an incompetent, and yet there might not be any order of guardianship which had established that formal relationship. And I think we ought to spell it out.
Retarded child at home.
Or retarded adult, for that matter, where the person is... Beg pardon?
Can we accept the legislature?
And the judiciary. And I didn't see anything in the commentary that spoke to this problem. And if we intended to be reasonably clear, I think we ought to either say that it means a legal declaration of incompetency or that it doesn't.
Well, I don't think it does mean that. This would be a matter of proof, wouldn't it? But your observation is that at least in the commentary that there should be some discussion.
Perhaps in the commentary, but at least let us specify whether we mean a technical decree of competency or not.
Don?
Well, I don't think that we had in mind specifying that there had to be a court order declaring incompetency when we formulated this definition. And I don't think New York had that in mind either.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we discussed this and we wanted to leave a degree of flexibility there. And I think it would be desirable to have flexibility so that it could be a matter of proof.
Well, that's what I would think.
I think that's all right.
Doesn't the law presume?
So long as the commentary makes it clear that is our intent. I don't disagree with that. I think that's probably the way to do it. I think the commentary ought to make it clear.
My question on this is, are we developing here, I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, but are we developing here another statutory rape situation where anybody doing anything with a 15-year-old girl or under it better make sure that they ask their parents for permission to take the girl out? Or, like, say, take 18 years old if you're going to have an adult court, picks up a 15-year-old girl and just takes her down, buys her a cup of coffee or this type of thing. Are we getting into a situation where this is kidnapping without any other crime occurring? Now, I agree that maybe we would want to make it kidnapping where an 18-year-old boy finds a 15-year-old runaway and keeps her in his apartment for a period of time. Maybe you want to make that kidnapping, but do you want to make a kidnapping where there really hasn't been...
would the other elements be present?
If he takes her down to drive-in, he's not restricting her from finding her.
He's got to try.
Well, it's by moving her from one place to another.
You have to intentionally restrict.
That isn't the crime. The crime is abducting.
Mm-hmm. Well, the crime
about restraint.
The crime is restraint. By restricting the movements so as to interfere substantially with her liberty. And you couldn't say that he's interfering with her liberty by taking her to the coat stand.
But it's without her consent, presumably, if she's under 16.
Yes, but yeah, I mean, see, she can't consent.
What he's getting at.
This is what I'm getting at.
But
you meet this, though. But you go beyond this. Don't worry about restraint for a minute. You get down to abduct. Because you get over into the kidnapping, the two degrees are in terms of abduction. Mm-hmm. And for abduction, you have to restrain a person with intent to prevent his liberation by either, one, secreting or holding him in a place where he is not likely to be found, or using or threatening to use deadly physical force. Perhaps we should get back there again, using or threatening to cause serious physical injury, but that's a sideline. But why, I know what's worrying you, Frank, and I would agree with what you said at that point, but I don't think that it becomes a problem because it doesn't become a part of the crime unless it becomes also a part of abduction.
That's why the other elements aren't present.
Yeah, but it would apply to your, a person commits a crime of unlawful imprisonment if he restrains another person. Well, that's a serious bodily injury. But back where you're talking about, where you only talk about restraining a person and not abducting him.
Well, even there, Frank, you still need an intentional restriction of the movements of the person to come within the definition of restraint.
I would also like to speak, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself, on the definition of relative.
Well,
Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, I could move to amend my motion by amending 1B so as to insert the word is on the second line between or and to accommodate Judge Burns' suggestion, so that that would read, if he is a child who's not yet reached his 16th birthday or his and it comes. I think that does read better.
The motion will be amended in that fashion if there's no objection. How about relative?
Are you leaving B already, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, no, not if you want. No,
we hate to keep holding things up.
Fine.
We've already, I think, come to the conclusion that we mean now incompetent in fact and not incompetent in law necessarily. But now, next, incompetent for what purpose? Incompetent to contract? Incompetent to make a will? Incompetent for
what purpose? Talking about mentally, aren't we?
I don't know.
Incompetency for consent.
Mentally incompetent.
Yeah. And do we have some definition of that somewhere that will aid us?
Well, we have a definition of committed person.
Yeah, but then you're getting back to where you've got a...
Well, as a perfectly competent person who is drugged, capable of giving consent. Are they incompetent at that point?
Right. Yes, they are incompetent.
Do we have a definition of mentally incompetent?
Then you get back further over far on whether you're going to require it to be legally incompetent.
I'm not so sure that you'd want to restrict it to mentally incompetent. You might have take a polio victim or someone who spends all his life essentially physically incompetent.
Well, but as long as they're physically incompetent, they still have the mental capacity to not consent, though. What we're worried about is somebody who's going to go along willingly, but because they're so stupid, they don't realize they shouldn't be going.
Tim, are we talking about somebody who's incapable of understandably consenting to the taking or the restraint?
Well, sure, that's really what you're talking about.
Well, I think I agree with Bud. We haven't done it by using the word incompetent.
Well, somebody said they wanted flexibility in this. Was it Harvey that described that as the legislature uses when they want to sit on the fence?
Well, I think that's in
Well,
I think Bud has a good point. I think there's a real question about a definition of incompetency within the purview of this statute. We're talking about the ability to give consent. That's, I think, what we mean.
I do. That's right. I think we're talking about mentally competent or incompetent, because and the whole thing relates, as you've indicated, to consent.
Well, all right, strike and put in substitute a mentally.
One is
a mentally. But we do get into the danger of the contention that the person has to be legally declared. But I think it's all right. A mentally might solve the problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this still doesn't answer the question raised by Representative Frost. It doesn't get to the hypnosis situation either. Maybe we're just grabbing at straws.
Well, we can take who is normally incompetent.
Well, that doesn't cover Jim's point. That's a good one. That's a person who is physically unable to... what do you do with a paraplegic who gets picked up and hauled out as a rich father?
Well, but he would be kidnapped.
But he wouldn't give consent.
He wouldn't consent.
I think competency is really
direct physical.
No, I don't think we're concerned about the competency contract or smoke or anything.
Can we put the words in? Is unable to understandably consent to or capable of?
That's what we're really getting at.
I think we're going to use the word incompetent, we're going to dig ourselves a big hole and the whole problem is behind it.
Bring this out here.
What we were trying to say was he's incompetent to consent.
Yeah. That's too far.
We don't want to be stuck with that definition.
Yeah.
couldn't you? You ought to really
eliminate that by, Mr. Chairman,
Judge Sloan,
using the word. Or is unable for any reason to understandably give a consent? At least.
Well, what would that mean?
The definition of the criminal responsibility law, we have such a hell of a time defining or reaching any conclusion on what incompetent is.
But what would it mean, who is unable to understandably give consent? We'd be encountering, that's what we're trying to get at. But this is the very statute by which we're attempting to define competency or incompetency, so here's where we have to put it for our purposes. Who has not reached the mental age of blank years or something, and then you've really got a matter of proof.
Now, you know,
Mr. Chairman, it seemed to me that this is a problem that could be handled much better in subcommittee.
I think so, too.
And I frankly think this particular problem of incompetency ought to be gone over by subcommittee.
Well, if
I agree with you.
If we could get an indication from the commission whether or not you agree with that there should be some type of provision to cover this type of situation, then we can come up with the right language.
I think you have to have it. Have something in here.
Purpose, if you're going to go back to subcommittee with this, and which I'm not too happy about because apparently I'm on that one now.
Oh, yeah.
But we need to go back to the other situation here, too. The question of whether or not it's a policy decision, we're just going to flat out say that anybody under 16 is in no event incapable of consenting, or if we're going to tie this whole thing into a question of fact as to whether or not the person understands what he is doing and is capable of making a decision as to whether to go along or not.
Frank's deal.
Yes, right. But why have an artificial standard and then an actual standard?
Could you go with what you said, Frank, or to vitiate the consent by anyone who, by reasons of age, mental incompetency, whatever, is incapable of giving a valid consent? And then leaving that to a fact determination.
Yeah. So I think the idea should be
about the age altogether.
Well, it could be one circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah, in other words, in a given case, 15 might qualify. And
well, we have I don't see any reason in having an artificial, they don't call it the age thing, being an artificial thing here in this when I presume we'll still have it in the rape situation.
John?
This, everybody's kind of at a disadvantage today because Jeannie Labrado did the drafting and all the members of the subcommittee which considered this through the three drafts are gone.
That's kind of ominous.
And it really wasn't kidnapping that killed him. But I think Wally would like to know. I mean, I would think perhaps maybe the whole kidnapping, now the rest of the kidnapping article is going to be less controversial and probably easier to get through, but I would think maybe it might be in order to at least delay this now and go to assault, see what we can get over. Although I would like to ask a question, or ask one question, because I think Wally's subcommittee should get some sense of direction from the commission in regard to which way you think we should go on kidnapping. And if you look at what we've drafted here, what Gene drafted, this New York approach with the affirmative defense in it and with the definitions in it is quite a departure from the Model Penal Code approach. And the Model Penal Code approach is really simpler. And the commission might think that maybe we ought to go the Model Penal Code route. It would obviate these questions with respect to age, these questions with respect to the definitions, and the questions that we've discussed with regard to this affirmative defense. Now, if it isn't in order, Mr. Chairman.
No, it's perfectly in order. Let's discuss it.
Mr. Chairman, well, Justice, are you referring to the Model Penal Code
212.1?
Right. Well, now, I was intended one subcommittee meeting, when I think I'm right on this, Don, that the thing that had the subcommittee that they were wrestling with and what drew them away from the Model Penal Code was this removing another from his place of business or residence.
Yeah.
That this was too restrictive.
Yes,
this is
that was one of the
objections,
yes.
The subcommittee, at least at that meeting, they devoted most of their concern to that, and in the first place, should it be so limited, and if not so limited, how to change it so that it wasn't. And they decided that this was too restrictive, and to broaden what kidnapping would be, and not limited just to taking from a place of business or a place of residence.
Well, following the
model, am I writing that down?
Yes, you are. Good.
Following the model penal approach, however, we could work in that idea, work in a restraint, right into this basic approach. Again, we have the same thing. They got a person's guilty of kidnapping if he unlawfully removes another. Without legal authority. But we could go make it broader so that it was more than just removes another from his place of residence business. And when this broader approach, it's in restraint in this definition. Without too much trouble.
I think you could too.
You'll notice the Model Penal Code also has an age in there. They use the age 14 respect to age of consent.
So you want to be careful. You leave
it
at 16.
They've also got terrorized
2 years
too.
Of voting age.
Model Penal Code.
I'm seeing a burn while the building below the voting
age. Yeah, 16. Do you think it's worthwhile to look at sections 4, 5, and the rest of this? I think that it might be a...
If you're going to alter this, the definitions at all, that kind of changes what you're talking about
well,
and the rest of it, doesn't it?
I don't think it will as much as you think. Let's look at section 4. Bearing in mind that restrain has been... already by men.
And you'd strike bodily and substitute physical there?
Yes.
Yes, that, there again, that should be physical. Our error.
Well,
now, of course, the big decision here is whether or not you even want an unlawful imprisonment statute to take care of some of the minor situations that maybe should be penalized in the criminal code but should not be considered as kidnapping. This is taken from New York, section 13510, and is similar to section 212.2 of the Model Penal Code, except that we only have one degree of the offense in this draft, whereas New York has 2 degrees.
Now, does this have any effect at all on the civil suit?
Well, we didn't think it did. We discussed this in subcommittee. We didn't think that this would have any effect. In fact, part of the discussion was whether or not this was even necessary and whether or not there were ample civil remedies available.
I really can't see the reason for a unlawful imprisonment criminal penalty for something that this kind.
No, Don, the minutes on page 6, 7, and 8 of the December 12th are very helpful.
Yeah, why don't you read it?
Okay. There were 2 degrees, and I moved at the end of the discussion to restrict it to 1 degree of unlawful imprisonment. But maybe this will help, and if it doesn't, tell us and we'll stop. Ms. Laverato explained that unlawful imprisonment in the second degree incorporated the definition of restraint. As defined in section 1, the crime differed from kidnapping in the second degree, she said, in that if a parent unlawfully took a child under 16 years of age, he would not be guilty of unlawful imprisonment, but would be guilty of that crime if the child were over 16. Custodial interference would apply to children under 16, so that there was no overlap between the two sections. The rationale of Section 4, she said, was that after the age the committee decided was the proper cutoff point, the child would be treated as an adult and the parent would not have the benefit of the exception stated in subsection 2 available to him, and would be treated as any other member of the population who committed the same crime. This is getting pretty technical, complicated. I don't know whether you can follow it. Maybe you can summarize it, Don.
Well, I think that she indicated that in Michigan, in New York, Michigan, in the Model Penal Code, unlawful imprisonment was a criminal offense. The argument being that this was the type of behavior the criminal law should attempt to discourage. Most of the case law involving unlawful imprisonment, she said, involved police departments in the southern states where there was a problem with police overstepping their powers. And in these situations, particularly the Model Penal Code, felt that civil remedies were not adequate. And as she advised, it was contemplated that this Section 4 would be a misdemeanor. Section 5 would be a felony. That's when he originally had two separate sections. Of course, the amendments indicate also that there was some discussion that Senator Burns brought up whether there had been any, whether the commission had received any request for this kind of legislation. And I advised the subcommittee that we had not received any request for this kind of legislation. This is incorporating a feeling of the drafters of the Model Penal Code. Actually, reading the minutes indicates that the subcommittee came quite close to deleting unlawful imprisonment completely, and then finally decided that it would leave one degree of the crime, one section.
Just to cover a situation where it might not amount to kidnapping, but yet the person has been placed in a perilous situation.
Well, what type of circumstances would there be that would fall in Section 4 and it wouldn't fall in 2 and 3?
Keep your wife whole, barefoot, and pregnant.
No, Senator Lynn has a bill that's going to take care of that.
You still have to expose the person to a risk of serious physical injury here in this Section 4.
See, I
agree with you, Jim.
I was all close race.
I think one possibility that was brought up at subcommittee was, for example, a campus, college campus situation where maybe the college president is locked up in a closet or something while they proceed to take over the office. This kind of situation, perhaps.
Does that expose him to serious
Was this a question of fact? Whether or not one situation might expose him to serious physical injury, I don't know.
Protracted impairment of health. Or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily organ.
I suppose you might say you could get into a situation where a guy being chased by the police holes up in a house. He may not keep the people there, but probably there's going to be a threat of physical force upon them to keep them there.
That was old Section 4. False imprisonment in the second degree. And Section 5 was false imprisonment in the first degree. Kind of.
I still can't see the difference between unlawful imprisonment and kidnapping in the second degree.
We need abduction.
Abduction.
Need abduction and kidnapping.
Even if he restrained him by threatening to use deadly physical force.
that's going to be threatening him with serious
bodily injury. That is one meaning of abduction. One meaning of abduction is abduction means to restrain a person with intent to prevent his liberation by either, then we get to B, and what we presently got, which I think is using or threatening to use deadly physical force.
Which in turn means using force under circumstances which readily are capable of causing serious
injury. Yeah, we get away from that hang up though, and went to what we talked about a little while ago. We'd say abduct means to restrain a person with intent to prevent his liberation by causing or threatening to cause serious physical injury. Then we'd go over here and we'd say a person commits the crime and that's got abduct in it. Then we really just say abduct here again. A person commits the crime of unlawful imprisonment if he abducts another person. That's what we're really saying when we say if he restrains another person under circumstances, so it's supposed to be first restrained to a risk of serious physical injury. We're just using the one of the definitions of abduct.
Yeah, let's
as you said,
you're
right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move to delete section 4.
Apparently the subcommittee, most of them felt that it was unnecessary.
We originally had it in 2 degrees,
including Justice Sloan.
I moved to cut one of the degrees out, but it seems to me that it's so close to the civil remedy. I mean, it gets the district attorney invariably into civil disputes, and there it does run the danger of being parallel to second-degree kidnapping. I don't think we serve any great public policy purpose by keeping it.
Yes, and as a matter of fact,
that could be a situation where you could really get into the perfect argument. If, as Bud says, when you're saying that you're committing kidnapping in the second degree of the abducted person, and really what we're saying in unlawful imprisonment is that they are abducting the person. That might possibly put it into a perky situation.
Well, I think that the minutes indicate that when we discuss it, this in the subcommittee, I expressed my opinion there that I wasn't persuaded that we needed this section in the kidnapping statutes. But the subcommittee felt it should be considered by the commission.
Question.
Is there any further discussion?
We're voting to delete it.
The motion is to delete. Section 4. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion is carried. Section 5. Now, will we run into definitions in here in this? Not that I recall.
We have incompetent used here again.
Yeah.
And we add committed, but we do define committed.
Yeah.
But don't we turn around right around in defining committed and come to the point of defining incompetent?
I think so.
I mean, at least what I think we're thinking about as far as incompetent.
We weren't trying, when we talked about incompetence, I mentioned in response to Judge Burns' question earlier, that we weren't necessarily talking about an incompetent who had been adjudged an incompetent as such. Whereas a committed person could include an incompetent, but we're not necessarily, by that definition, I think, restricting incompetent, since we use it the alternative, any incompetent or a committed person.
Isn't there a conflict between section 1 where it says he takes or entices any child who has not yet reached his 16th birthday from the custody of his parents, the policy being that we're just going to use that as a cutoff date, and in section 2, the third line, or other dependent entrusted to another's custody by authority of law? Wouldn't that be a conflict?
Could have. Probably do that.
17-year-old entrusted to another's custody by authority of law. An 18-year-old.
He just wasn't generous, whatever that means.
I think we do.
You think that'd be a conflict?
Well, under subsection 2, couldn't you? Aren't we saying that if you have someone who has custody of an 18-year-old, interference with it. Yeah. The custodial interference in the second degree.
You could entice a 16-year-old away from its parents' custody, but you couldn't entice a 16-year-old away from the foster home custody. You'd be committing a crime if you did.
Even in custody.
Because he's a
dependent person entrusted to another by authority of law, namely his father and mother.
Mr. Chairman, is the Valley Migrant League a recognized social agency?
That was the next one I was going to get into.
Yes, I probably is.
I think that recognized social agency is a term that ought to be avoided because, as far as I'm concerned, Hubcap might be, and even more, God forbid, Cherix might be a recognized social agency. As a matter of fact, it's been accorded undue recognition lately, according to some of its members.
What about the outside in?
Well,
that needs a little tighter.
Inside out.
That's the one that reminds you of the old song about laughing on the outside, crying on the inside.
You know, fellas, we just can't get there from here. The whole thing's going back to subcommittee. Just go to a song.
He hung in there.
It can't be done.
Mr. Chairman, before it does, may I point out two things?
Yes.
For the benefit of the subcommittee. In 6(2), which is custodial interference in the second degree, the language is used about the person's safety will be endangered or his health materially impaired. And it seems to me that these are significant differences from our previous language of serious physical injury, and that ought to be cleared up. And then secondly, when the whole thing goes back, I think the subcommittee ought to take another look at its definition of relative in section 1, because they talk about adopted relatives of the same degree through marriage or adoption. And I think that, without going into spending a lot of your time here today, I think that also could receive some further attention.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we'll just make kidnapping lawful and report back.
It'll be easier. It's gone back.
So nobody was here except Don. They've all been replaced. That's rather an ominous.
Can we have any expression of what they'd like us to do with it?
Yeah, very good question. What do you want? What do you want the subcommittee to do with it? See, what direction with respect, for example, to including the defenses in second degree? Do you want to follow the Model Penal Code or the Illinois, actually, too, or the pattern that's adopted in this particular draft?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that we made a basic policy decision early to avoid affirmative defenses as much as we could throughout the whole revision.
Yeah.
And I think that the subcommittee should make every effort to avoid an affirmative defense here. With that in mind, I think the Model Penal Code approach is more concise. They have some disturbing language in there, like a substantial distance and for a substantial period, etc. But I think you should avoid the affirmative defense. I also think that we should retain a crime for custodial interference. There has to be some provision for that.
Yeah.
But that's my two cents.
Well, is there anyone who disagrees with the Burns pronouncement?
Could I inquire, Mr.
Well, doesn't help. I don't necessarily know that the doing away with the affirmative defense.
Of course, that's a matter of drafting.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you draft your definitions so as to get around child stealing by an estranged parent bit, which is what that subsection was designed for.
Don, you had a question.
Well, I wanted to inquire whether or not, with respect, say, to Section 3, kidnapping in the first degree, if it was the feeling of the commission that these are good and acceptable reasons for enhancing the degree of kidnapping. We feel that these are legitimate and reasonable differences between one degree of kidnapping and a more serious degree.
I personally do. I don't know how the rest of you do.
The only comment I'd have to make on that, Mr. Chairman, is that I would be much happier with the definition of terrorized, which Dave has already spoken. And I also wonder whether or not some commentary language might be useful in defining hostage, or whether or not that term is such a degree of acceptance as to be readily understandable. I'm not sure that it does. And I think that the commentary, some commentary language on hostage would be useful.
Well, Don, why don't you use the robbery burglary enhancement factor? Did inflict serious physical injury or attempts to inflict deadly physical force or something. Do we have a common enhancement factor that you've applied uniformly through robbery, burglary, and two or three other
We can examine that and see whether or not we could use the same factors on kidnapping.
I think we run some difficulty in sub 1 of section 3 of going headlong into extortion, but you're aware of that.
Well, Wally, with those simple directions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm serious. I didn't see this.
All right, Mr. Chairman, did you want to go ahead now with assault?
No,
I thought we just finished it.
Yeah. I don't need an assault on me.
How I feel that we happened.
Wally, were you driving when assault was considered?
Yes, indeed. It certainly was. And I'd like to have Don go through it. Don, do you want to take it first?
Okay, I'll just, as I did with the last article, give you just a broad overview on the thing, and then we'll go back through it section by section again. We have five sections in this article, assault in the third degree, assault in the second degree, and then first degree. We have a new crime called menacing, and a new one called recklessly endangering another person. Assault under this draft is made a separate substantive offense. The seriousness of the crime of assault would depend upon the culpability with which the defendant committed the act, the seriousness of the injury inflicted upon the victim, and the means employed, such as a dangerous or deadly weapon. Now, the commentary includes a chart which sets down the degrees of assault and the kind of culpability that's required. And I think if you look at page 6, there's a good statement from the New York commentary with respect to assault, which applies equally to our draft. And that is that the proposed assault formulation requiring actual physical injury places the crime of assault in the main category of offenses, robbery, larceny, perjury, etc., which are committed only when the offender succeeds in his criminal objective. As with other offenses of this nature, an unsuccessful endeavor, common law assault not resulting in a battery, constitutes and would constitute an attempt under our draft. Attempted assault, then, would be governed by the same rules which apply to attempts to commit other crimes. And they go on to say, it will be necessary to discuss attempted assault in terms of the law of attempts, in particular in regard to the elements of proximity and impossibility. And then they set out the definition of attempt. Our commentary here also has the Model Penal Code definition of attempt. And I would like to mention this, that the article on inchoate crimes, which includes attempt, is drafted in rough form, and I think it would be helpful as we consider this assault article to keep this in mind. Now, Professor Platt is working on the attempt definition. And his early draft defines attempt in this way. A person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime when he purposely engages in conduct which would constitute such crime by performing or omitting to perform an act which constitutes a substantial step towards commission of the crime. That definition is quite similar to the approach that's been taken. Well, the language is a little different. The rationale is pretty much the same as model penal code approach in California and New York and the others. So that when we think of assault, then we are making quite a change in our existing law, in that we're not thinking in terms of something that doesn't quite reach a battery. This is because this, in effect, is more like what we think of now as a battery type, where there's actually a battery type offense because there is an injury inflicted upon the victim. On page 10 of the draft, there's commentary there, I think, which is important. The Oregon case law definition of an attempt now is any intentional attempt by force or violence to do injury to the person of another, coupled with the present ability to do such an injury. Assault can mean either one, an act which reasonably puts one in fear of corporal injury, or two, an act intended to cause corporal injury by one who has the present ability to carry out such intent. Thus, the tort law-derived concept of intentional creation of the apprehension of receiving a battery exists in present Oregon case law and will be retained under the proposed draft under the newly designated offense of menacing. The proposed draft does embody a reorientation of present Oregon law. It limits assault as a concept to the infliction of actual physical injury. It makes assault a substantive crime and does away with the requirements of present ability, leaving the general attempt provisions controlling. And then we cite State versus Wilson, a 1959 Oregon case, in which the court said, "We are of the opinion that criminal assault, even as defined by this court, should be regarded as a distinct crime rather than an uncompleted battery. The mere fact that assault is viewed as preceding a battery should not preclude us from drawing a line on one side of which we require the present ability to inflict corporal injury, denominating this as assault and the other side conduct which falls short of a present ability, yet so advanced towards the assault that it is more than mere preparation, in which we denominate an attempt. It's intended that an attempt to commit an assault is a lesser included offense, and the conviction under this draft would be for an attempt where that's shown by the evidence but not the assault."
Well, you're completely throwing State versus Wilson out, though, with your definition of assault.
As assault, and not as menacing.
Because you're now saying that assault is the battery and not the assault.
Right.
And so, I mean, the question State versus Wilson was, because if you use the definition of an assault as being an attempted battery, could you have an attempted assault? Because it was an attempt to commit an attempt.
Yeah, right.
And they said no, that assault was a separate crime, so you could have an attempted assault. But now we're getting back to the point again where you now